Hello, and thanks for joining us to Remapping the Model of Production Techniques. I am Amandine Prat, and I'm co-chairing this workshop with Paul Thompson from Leeds Beckett University in England. I will introduce this workshop and its panelists with some background on our West African fieldwork and some explanations on how this collaboration came together at Virtual Vienna AES today. So I teach audio production techniques in the Digital Audio Arts program at the University of Lethbridge in Western Canada, and our classroom looks like this. My students have the luxury to learn how to mix on an SSL duality that offers the choice between the E series or the G series EQ, and that includes a dynamic section with a compressor and a gate on each of the 48 channels. This studio also features Pro Tools HD, a digital audio workstation that was built in emulation of analog console desk, with the option to stack EQs and compressors on each track. One question that this panel will address is how do beatmakers, arrangers, and engineers who produce music outside of privileged areas learn and use the templates of digital audio workstations that are designed in countries where there is a lineage of analog recording production? I already wanted to examine this question after I finished my PhD at McGill about music production practices in the digital era, and I traveled to India, where I did not observe big differences in studio production techniques compared to what I knew from Europe and North America. And this made sense because I was teaching audio production at the New York University at the time, and I had students from India and from other parts of the world. So we could say that the expansion of audio programs in privileged countries has globalized the lineage of analog recording production to a certain extent. In India, instead of conducting a recording studio study, I directed a video documentary with musicians. And when I presented the concept of this documentary at a symposium in Paris, I met ethnomusicologist Emmanuel Olivier, who showed me her footage from a recording session in Bamako, Mali. And I noticed right away that the workflow of the engineer was not influenced by the technology from the past, as I was used to see elsewhere. Mali has an incredible music culture. The country has gone through a political and security crisis since 2012, which has pushed all the expert audio engineers and producers away, but not the musicians. In the last few years, the number of digital studios in Bamako has raised exponentially. And the upcoming generation of studio practitioners is mostly self-taught, using shared knowledge of the local network and YouTube tutorials to learn how to use their DAW. Emmanuel Olivier invited me to join her research partnership titled Afrinum Digital Cultures in West Africa, Music, Youth, and Mediation. This partnership involves a team of 18 researchers. The French and West African teams are funded by the National Research Agency, and my Canadian team is funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada under the project titled the West African Audio Network, which emphasizes on audio education. With Emmanuel, I flew to Bamako in July 2018 and 2019 with a couple of cameras, a Bloomline Royer SF-12, and a stereo Tascam recorder to collect data in recording studios. Back in Canada, I hired research assistants among my undergrad students to analyze this data. Their experience in producing music in DAW without being as influenced as I am by the analog recording workflow enables a more valid comparison between studio production in Canada and in Mali. Léonard Menon is one of my research assistants. He got the Chinook Summer Research Award to focus on this project over the next few months. Today, he will show us how he incorporates the DAW tricks that he learned from Malian producers into his own productions. Mal Peno, alias Maelstrom, started a PhD thesis funded by Afrinum that consists of fieldwork in recording studios at Dakar in Senegal. I invited Mael on this panel because he learned DJ practices in Paris without following a structured curriculum, which is not the case of the other participants of this workshop. On the one hand, the West African Audio Network brings a solid audio engineering expertise on anthropological fieldwork studies in five West African countries. And on the other hand, This project includes 6 month residencies in a Banff audio recording engineer practicum for young West African studio professionals. James Clement Seeley, who is the coordinator of this practicum, will highlight the learning experience of Issa Traoré, alias Ken Lagare, who attended this program this year. And this is Ken's studio in Bamako, named Authentic Studio. You can see a little voice cabin with a microphone and a pop filter in the back. It is very tiny. I met Paul Thompson at the New York convention when I presented some findings from my Bamako fieldwork with two of my research assistants. I will now let him shed some light on the education framework of learning methods to develop studio production skills. I will see you again at the end of these presentations for the panel discussion.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our workshop. I'm Paul Thompson. I'm a professional recording engineer and a reader in music and sound and performance at Leeds Beckett University. I'll be introducing the context for our discussions in the workshop today. And these are focused on the broad area of education and learning strategies. Education is often grouped into three broad forms: formal, non-formal, and informal. And these are characterized by their methods of learning. Formal education is normally delivered in an educational institution and uses a structured curriculum. Non-formal education can take place either outside or inside an institution and normally involves a loosely designed curriculum or tailor-made program to suit learners' needs. And non-formal teaching methods sometimes emphasize oral and aural methods, engaging learners in both auditory and visual formats. And finally, informal music education involves acquiring knowledge and developing skills without a structured curriculum. Learning methods and approaches include watching and copying teachers, family, friends, recordings or performances. Research into how recording engineers and music producers learn within each of these categories are in their infancy, and there's very little academic inquiry around the methods and modes of learning involved. As a useful starting point, we have ethnographic work that's been done on popular musicians. Bennett's work in Colorado, USA, for example, outlined how a person becomes a local rock musician in a covers band and plays to an audience. Sarah Cohen's empirical work with amateur rock musicians illuminated aspects of music making in Liverpool, whilst Ruth Finnegan's work uncovered hidden musicians and their patterns of music making in Milton Keynes. Ethnographic studies into popular electronic music and musicians, and in particular dance musics, typically gloss over the finer points of music making in favour of a broader discussion of the cultures surrounding them. Although Kiefer Kenchner's ethnographic work in the area of underground dance music in New York City is one of the minority studies that provides a detailed account of DJ practices, and through extended discussion with practitioners and participant observation of performances, Kenchner covers the cult and culture of the DJ. And through empirical analysis, both technique and technology, considers the musical skills of the DJ and the DJ's musical instrument. Studies on hip-hop performance and production too are in the main more concerned with a broader discussion of hip-hop's cultural and socio-political context. And empirical studies in this area of music making are relatively few. Although learning practices are only inferred throughout the majority of these studies, they do provide a sufficient starting point on which to base a discussion into the development of recording engineers and music producers. Lucy Green, for example, considers informal music learning practices as sharing few or none of the features of formal education. And musicians pick up skills and knowledge through their own endeavours by watching and listening to other musicians. Green also reaffirmed that most popular musicians historically found formal music education alienating and difficult to relate to. Lucy Green's analysis of how popular musicians learn draws heavily on interviews with popular musicians within further and higher educational settings in the United Kingdom. She noted that young popular musicians were able to make connections between many of the skills and knowledge they acquired through formal and informal means. But in spite of this and all of her evidence, their informal learning practices continued unabated. In other words, informal methods of learning used by popular musicians weren't embedded into the curriculum. studies within a Western large recording studio context have been useful in highlighting some of the learning practices involved with apprenticeship. In 2014, myself, Bob Davis, and Steve Parker conducted research into a range of participants with extensive industry experience, as well as graduate entrants to the broad profession of sound engineering. We found that a good deal of the early experiences of these professionals relied on what Dewson refers to as peripheral participation and situated learning. In this way, learning goes beyond achieving a formalized set of learning outcomes and moves towards a more diverse learning experience. This is due in part to the lack of any formalized training in apprenticeship. And it was evident in all of the responses from the participants who'd begun their career in larger recording facilities. This apparent lack of formal structure meant that designated tasks, roles, and responsibilities were staggered over a period of time, in which certain roles or tasks had to be mastered before one could move on to others. This process was seen to have significant advantages, as it allowed the opportunity to become more involved as their skills and knowledge developed over time. A number of the participants in this study noted that it took several years, ranging from 2 to 6 years, to progress from their starting position as a runner to assisting on a recording session. One engineer in the study pointed out that the element that's missing from a lot of formal programs in education is the element of observation, observing tons of different practitioners on a daily basis. They said you just can't beat that as a form of education, and it's so difficult to replicate a real-world scenario. The advantage we had was that we saw things that didn't work and we were able to fill up our toolbox with these experiences. Finally, there are studies on how recording engineers and music producers have learnt completely informally, typically where access is enabled socioeconomically and individuals can afford to buy equipment and learn through trial and error. Simon Zagorski-Thomas explains that technical knowledge and dissemination within the commercial recording industry grew out of employment in the military, telecommunications, radio and broadcast media. And in tandem with this, the appearance of commercial hobby kits and literature in the 1950s and 1960s contributed to the dissemination of these forms of knowledge. He further adds that the software elements of contemporary production and to a lesser extent, the generic computer hardware provide parallels with electronics hobbyists in earlier periods. Communities or working relationships often grow around a particular expert hobbyist to whom the others can turn to for advice and help. And this often results in informal hierarchies of expertise, many of which now exist as forums on the internet. And so innumerable engineers and record producers have acquired this knowledge entirely informally, setting up their own recording facilities, engineering or producing their friends' bands, engineering and producing their own music, and learning through trial and error. And so through continuing involvement with engineering and producing, engineers and producers become immersed into the recording studio context and eventually becoming cultured into the domain of commercial record production. Larvey and Wenger define the process of learning within a given context as situated learning. And the recording studio is an environment with existing social expectations, conventions and practices. And groups of people who share these conventions are considered to be a community of practice. Wenger explains that communities of practice share a concern, a set of problems, or a passion about a topic, and who deepen their knowledge and expertise in this area by interacting on an ongoing basis. The social skills and knowledge associated with the domain of record production are acquired almost entirely informally through experience and immersion into the environment of the recording studio. And this process of enculturation is a fundamental factor that's common to all aspects of music learning, whether formal or informal. So what then can formal education learn from the informal situated learning practices of communities and cultures with a different cultural and historic context? To date, there's been only a handful of studies in this area of informal learning practices of music producers and audio engineers. Amadeen's study with young engineers in New York, for example. And so the following workshop underlines the growing importance of investigating informal learning methods, specifically outside the Anglo-American musical sphere. And as Amadeen mentioned in the introduction, we're going to look at the following areas. the development of the digital audio workstation and the practices that surround it in informal contexts in different countries. Informal methods of learning, including apprenticeship, the use of YouTube tutorials, and local networks of people to exchange knowledge. We're also going to introduce the influence of the design and presentation of the DAW and the digital audio tools on informal learning practices. And also we're going to look at the impact of learning audio engineering and music production within a purely digital context and the ways in which the digital paradigm influences the practices of sound recording, audio processing, mixing, and mastering. And finally, we're going to try and underline the need for ethnographic methods in studying trends in knowledge exchange and the learning practices in audio education and non-Anglo-American music and production processes. I'll see you soon.
Hi, everyone. I'm Maël Penaud. I'm an electronic music producer and performer and also a PhD student at the School for Advanced Studies in the Social Sciences in Paris. I've been doing fieldwork in Dakar, in Senegal, with beatmakers and studio engineers for a total of 6 months in 2019 as part of the Afrinum research project directed by Emmanuel Olivier. So we don't have that much time, so what I'll be doing is a short description of the studios I've seen in Dakar and of how people record and produce music there. And then maybe we can go more into the details during our conversation at the end of this panel. So first thing to know, there's no access to proper studio training in Senegal, no schools, university courses. So the only ways to learn studio techniques are by watching YouTube tutorials or mentoring. Is it through informal internships in existing studios or through friends and relatives? So in Dakar, there's roughly three types of studios. There's a handful of professional studios with a set of different microphones, a recording booth, a mixing board, and some acoustic treatment to the rooms. These studios are often located in dedicated buildings or apartments. There's also home studios housed in a dedicated room inside of the owner's apartment or building, generally without a booth, but they still allow people to come in for sessions, mostly for vocal recordings. And then there's bedroom studios, basically the same as everywhere else. So engineers working in professional studios are expected to have at least some kind of hardware, and they also operate within a larger spectrum of music styles, when home and bedroom studios mainly focus on hip-hop and urban music. But even when hardware is available at hand, it's almost never used. At Studio Sankara, which is one of the most famous studios in Dakar, there's a Behringer X32 mixer placed in front of the recording booth with a rack mount full of compressors and EQs. I spent a couple of days there observing the mixing process of an album, and by the end of the first session, I asked the engineer why he wasn't using any of the hardware that he had in the studio. He straight up answered that although he knew how to use them, the Behringer and the compressors were only there to impress his clients and to show them that they were indeed in a professional studio. He told me that he was much more comfortable working in the box with Logic and his UAD plugins. But still, him and his client kept insisting on the fact that there were rules to follow in order to achieve a professional sound. When I asked them about their references, it was mostly music from the 80s and 90s, music that's been released by major companies and that's been recorded in studios with a lot of equipment. Stuff like Youssou N'Dour, Salif Keita, Ali Farka Touré. In terms of generations, these studios belong to people who are generally slightly older than beatmakers and hip-hop producers. And some of them have had access to recording studios in Europe or in the US, sometimes as session musicians on an album, or they had an opportunity to record in Paris or in the US during a tour. So here, that's just one example, but in general, in these kind of studios, they tend to follow a more conventional approach to the recording process in terms of how and when instruments and vocals are recorded, what kind of mics and preamps are best for guitars or for vocals, how to mix down and when, like where you put a compressor in an FX chain, these kind of things, even though they're using software tools to achieve that result. In home and bedroom studios, it's mostly younger beatmakers in their 20s who got their knowledge from YouTube tutorials made on Fruity Loops by Western hip-hop producers. So their approach to production is entirely different and more fluid. The mixing, editing, the producing phases happen all at once with almost no reference to hardware equivalents or more conventional practices. These beatmakers usually aspire to reproduce the trajectories of famous beatmakers who work from their own place or even from hotel rooms or airport lounges. Names like Pierre Bourne or Metro Boomin are on everyone's lips in Dakar. So here it's the software skills which will be valued, as well as how fast they can deliver. Even when they mix a track or work on a master for someone else's music, the artist will generally not be sitting in on the session. So there's no incentive for them to look professional or to follow certain rules, and they tend to rely mostly on their own collection of plugins and presets in a way that somehow works for them, but would be considered totally unorthodox anywhere else. They know that there needs to be limiters, multiband compressors, or EQs, but in most cases, they don't fully understand why and how these plugins are supposed to work. So it's a mix of replicating what they've seen on YouTube and using their ears to combine their ears and their experience to combine different types of plugins and presets to achieve a certain result. So they'll know that this preset on this plugin will give them a certain type of result, and they will mostly use this particular plugin because of this preset, while almost never tweaking the parameters. So in the end, like their mastering chain of their FX chain on a drum bus, it will be something like a collection of presets put together in order to achieve a certain result, and not like as opposed to a series of devices that would have been selected because of their components or capabilities and then adjusted to a specific sound source. When it comes to production, beatmakers are mostly using, as I was saying, software sources and samples. And I haven't seen any drum machines, hardware synths, or FX pedals in the studios I've been able to study. But as much as beatmakers are trying to emulate the sound of the global urban music they're listening to on YouTube or on the radio, they also very strongly express their desire to localize their music in order to make it connect with their local audiences. I found out that they were using different processes to achieve that. First, they'll be very often trying to include local drum sounds in the productions, hiring a local drummer, recording sessions with them at different tempos, and then selecting loops or isolating individual drum hits within sound banks that they'll be able to use at a later time in the productions. They also sometimes do the same thing backwards somehow and reference traditional percussion rhythm patterns by replicating them on their DAWs while using drum machine sounds, like 808 samples, for instance. Another way for these beatmakers to localize their sound is to use the marimbalar in their production. So the marimbalar is a very specific sound to the Senegalese popular music, and it's been introduced in the early 80s into the mbalax music sound by artists like Youssou N'Dour. It's a preset on the Yamaha DX7 digital synthesizer. And this preset was designed by Jean-Philippe Riquiel, a keyboard player from Paris, as part of a bank he was doing in order to replicate West African sounds on the DX7, thanks to the possibilities offered by the FM synthesis. Long story short, today this sound is everywhere in Senegal and there are hundreds of DX7s in the country. But until very recently, this sound was impossible to find online or to use within a DAW. So several beatmakers in Dakar have used Contact to design virtual marimbalar instruments based on samples of the original preset taken from DAX7s that someone lended them or that they rented for an afternoon. So by doing so, they're using globalized digital tools and techniques to localize their music even as this sound itself comes from a digital synthesizer from the 1980s. So that's just a few examples of how the exposure to the culture of analog recording or production can shape the digital practices of Senegalese studio professionals, and how, on the opposite, for younger generations, it's mostly going to be the templates and presets within the AWs and plugins and the influence of YouTube tutorials that will shape their studio practices.
Hi, my name is Leonard Menon. I'm a fourth year student at the University of Lethbridge, and I'm taking the Digital Audio Arts program. I've been working on the Afronym project since early 2020. The producers that I'll be referencing today are Omar Konate, Abubakar Sidibe, aka Pap Jr., and Junior's assistant Abbas. So I'm just going to begin by elaborating on some of the interesting techniques that they use during the recording portion of their sessions. One of the first things that I noticed was the fact that they would always, almost always, enlarge the track that they were about to record on. Now, it seems like a very small thing, but, you know, that's not really something that I think about too much when I record. You know, I try to just use my ears if something sounds out of whack. But I didn't realize how powerful it was to actually expand your view. You know, it gives you another visual indicator of what's happening within the track. As small of a method as this might seem, is actually quite a powerful one. So when these producers working with their artists, a common thing that they would do is they would loop record. So creating layers of the same section of the song, and they would just get the artist to continually do the section until they had enough information that they could actually build the line that they wanted out of all of those takes. So, you know, they would take maybe the beginning of the third take, the center of the eighth take, and then, you know, like the final transient of like the seventh take, things like that, in order to build the most perfect and intended line that they wanted. Oftentimes, they'll actually edit while they're recording. But the interesting thing that I saw with Omar was that he knew his DAW, which was Cubase. He knew his DAW so well that he knew how to edit without bugging the system. He figured out that editing the clip gain on the clip itself would actually bug a recording session if he was actually recording. One last thing that I want to mention before diving into my own session is their inherent musical ability, which they're able to utilize in a creative way during these recording sessions. One of the craziest things that I actually saw when I was analyzing Omar's recording session was that he went into his MIDI engine, and he noticed that there was a bit of a pitch decorrelation, I guess. There was something that just wasn't lining up tuning wise, and you know, he was recording actual instruments, traditional instruments in West African culture, and so you can't exactly, you know, sometimes you can't, they don't facilitate tuning. And what he did was he went into the MIDI engine and actually adjusted the scent value himself. I think the most fascinating arrangement techniques that I saw was utilizing the subdivision parameter and maximizing the amount of subdivisions you can get when you're writing in MIDI. So this is an old track of mine. I wrote in some MIDI that's pretty easy on the ears. Nothing, you know, nothing too exciting, right? And you can see that everything here is being quantized. So let's go up here and let's change our grid value to 64th notes. So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna edit the next 8 bars, and I'm just going to write in some MIDI notes that were not originally possible by using the 16th note subdivision, and we'll see what kind of stuff we come up with. All right, so let's take a listen to what I've got. So here, what I'll do is I'll actually go and select all these notes, and I'm gonna quantize them as if to make it seem like these notes are actually built on a 16th note grid. It's not bad, you know, but similar to how dissonance is used in music, we could use a little bit of deviation from here. What I saw one of the producers do is he actually went into the grid value again and changed it into a triplet. Now we're obviously in a duple meter right now. So when I change it into triplet, you can see that things aren't lining up. And in order to fix that, what you can do is you can just subdivide once more. So what this allows you to do is it frees up the possibility of doing both a duple and a triple meter within the same project without changing any of the grid parameters. So I wrote one earlier. So what I've done over here is I have triplet feel once more. So again, yeah, this just frees up a lot of the possibilities when it comes to writing in MIDI. So to close off my portion of the presentation, there's one last thing that I would like to bring up, which is just their relationship between the artist. You know, a lot of these producers were also, you know, obviously they're the engineer, the producer. Sometimes they were the arranger, they're an instrumentalist on the album, a coach sometimes, you know. Wearing all of those hats and being able to still pursue a creative product that is both satisfying for the artists as well as themselves is quite inspiring. Their positivity, their genuine passion for the music, you know, like they'll be behind the board, you know, bobbing their head, you know, there's points where one of the artists will just improvise a line and they'll clap and they love it, and it's a really, really nurturing relationship between the producer and what a lot of us would consider their client. And the way they communicated with each other was just on a mutual basis, and I just really loved that entire concept, and that's something that I do actually take into any of my recording sessions that I do with actual artists.
Hi, my name is James Clemens Seely. My part of the presentation is going to focus on strength and diversity and learning through doing at the Banff Center Recording Engineer Practicum Program. For anyone who doesn't know, Banff Center up in Canada is a sort of post-secondary learning institution with many different things going on, one of which is some audio engineer training programs. And before the pandemic put everything into a sort of freeze mode, I was the senior recording engineer there and the head mentor for this program, which would have between 7 and 10 training engineers focused on a non-curriculum-based, non-degree-granting, experiential learning program. The main program goal was to increase the wisdom of the participants in it through a dynamic balance of analysis and theoretical teaching with a heavy dose of project-based experiential learning opportunities. So it's a real mix of book smarts and street smarts. One thing that makes it different from most apprenticeship programs or most internships in studios is that it's really the goal of the program is the education and the expansion of the trainees, and the fact that the studio happens to make records or work on film scores or record concerts for music programs or live stream events, all of that is a vehicle for the training experience. An advantage that we have compared to more traditional sort of Western classroom-based programs is that there's a very high ratio, you know, 1 or 2 to 5 or 10 of mentors to trainees. And that allows us to engage meaningfully the trainees and really like rotate through different levels of responsibility and different tasks and different projects and have the sort of high pressure situation of real world delivery objectives, but still with the security blanket of mentorship and oversight and crew management. There's no hierarchy in who's there. Everyone who comes into the program has been chosen for their diverse backgrounds. Some people are working in some kinds of music. Some people are more producer artists. Some people are more pure engineers. Some people are just finishing school. Some people are, you know, in the midst of the early stages of a career freelancing. Huge variety. And so they all come and they're given responsibilities either based on what their strengths are or what their weaknesses are. So either we want this project to succeed, and so we put someone who's most ready for it on it, or we want this person to gain a lot of experience and grow in a meaningful way, and so we'll put them on a project that maybe they don't have a lot of experience on. The diversity of the applicants is, I think, the greatest strength that the program has. In the 3 years since I started there, I've seen people in the program from almost every continent on the planet. In collaboration with Amandine and the Afrinum project, we managed to bring Ken Issa Traore over from Mali in Africa. And I think that's the first time there's been someone from the African continent coming directly to the program. And it's really something that maybe we could not have done anywhere else, where if there were strict curriculum objectives, and like hardcore, you know, testing and accreditation mandates in the program, we're not as flexible to take people from such varying backgrounds and have them contribute to each other's learning. A great example of bringing Ken, who did not have a ton of the sort of Western traditional studio hardware-based experience, is mostly self-taught based on YouTube videos, like Maelstrom was talking about. An example of where he turned everyone on their heads was when we were doing a listening class on vocal mixing. And when Ken presented his and was talking about his methodology, as opposed to everyone else in the room who'd sort of learned a fairly typical, I start with the rhythm section, low frequency instruments up to high frequency instruments, then the last thing I do is the vocal. And then with my processing, all I do is EQ things and then compress things and finish off with the reverb. Ken had started with the soloed lead vocal and spent a lot of time crafting the reverb around it to put the space of the storytelling element of the song in the forefront as the foundation, and then build everything up around that once it was established. And you could really see this sort of room full of people from Latvia, China, the US, Canada, looking at this situation and thinking, that's crazy. It's totally different from how I've done it. It must be wrong. Wait a second. It makes a lot of sense. If this is a storytelling song, we put the story first and build around that. My goodness, have I been doing it wrong? This is a whole new tactic for me to learn. And that sharing that comes from diverse backgrounds is irreplaceable. We also have a lot of equipment in the place, which lets people learn through hands-on. And there's a lot of time sort of dedicated to solo study. And many people will come in having experienced only a DAW-based training environment, if it was self-taught or in classrooms. A lot of the time their exposure to hardware is fairly minimal, and in the business today you could make a pretty good argument that a lot of the hardware that people have is just purely to show that it's a studio, and that look, we have these pieces of furniture that, you know, are about as useful as a paperweight or a chair. But one of the things that we pride ourselves on focusing a lot on at the center is comparing methodologies, comparing usage cases. And so we'll have digital emulations of the analog hardware that we have in the studio and have days that are dedicated to listening to the two of them, working with them in different contexts, and really sort of exploring how learning a specific tool doesn't only translate to opportunities where you have that specific tool later on. And this is one of the things I worked on with Ken a lot, was when you leave and go back home, you're not going to have this device. What's the point of learning it? And the point is, it'll change how you listen to things and how you attack things. And the more tools you know how to use, the more you can use any tool. In talking about the diversity of the participants in the program, I think one of the biggest assets that that yields is a non-competitive atmosphere. Their finances while they're in the program are stable because there's no tuition that's not subsidized, and there's a living stipend, and they all get the same amount regardless of their experience level coming in or their performance on campus. So everything about the economics of their being a recording engineer is under control. And there is also not going to be any competition when they all go back to different countries, different cities, and start to or continue building their careers. So it's very easy to share and not feel like you're shooting yourself in the foot by sacrificing your edge in an already quite competitive business. We build this atmosphere of learn from each other. You are your greatest asset, and the community you build can be your greatest strength. And I think that's something that's really incredible and really valuable. And the students see that and value that when we talk to them about their experience in the program.